Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1093, The Destabilization of China, Part 4. This is being recorded on October 22nd of the year 2019. We're going to continue with our examination of not only the situation in Hong Kong, but what I believe is an active destabilization program against China as a whole. And this is not only relevant to China, but as we get into discussion of Xinjiang province, a semi-autonomous region, rather like Hong Kong, by the way. I'm probably mispronouncing that. That's X-I-M-J-I-A-N-G. It is a mineral-rich area and petroleum-rich area in particular, with a large Uyghur population. That's U-I-G-H-U-R. The Uyghurs are a Turkophone, that is, Turkish-speaking Muslim minority in China, elements of whom have strong links not only with NATO, U.S., and German intelligence, but are also involved with Al-Qaeda, the Muslim Brotherhood, and ISIS. One of the things that Uyghur activists have been pushing for quite some time is secession from China and the establishment of a Muslim Turkophone state in Eurasia, which would unite parts of what is now China, like Xinjiang, with parts of what is now Russia, like elements of the Caucasus. What is worth noting about this is that these areas are, surprise, surprise, very rich in natural resources, petroleum in particular, and the loss of those would basically cripple Russia and would certainly do a lot of damage to China. The Uyghurs are a major focal point of pan-Turkish activism and propaganda that is disseminated and supported by Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey. He has gained publicity this past week, really more than just a week, but after Donald Trump pulled U.S. forces in Syria back, the Turkish and some of their jihadist allies then launched a major offensive into Syria against areas held by the Kurds and are engaging in ethnic cleansing by many accounts. This is worth noting because the same pan-Turkish ideology that Erdogan is, and by the way, E-R-D-O-G-A-N, I mispronounced that in the past, I call him Erdogan or then Erdogan. Apparently, it is pronounced Erdogan. In any event, he is an heir to a pan-Turkish philosophy that we covered at great length in AFA program number 14 and in numerous For the Record shows as well. Pan-Turkism overlaps Islamism, and Erdogan appears to be both a Muslim Brotherhood Islamist fascist and also a pan-Turkist fascist along the lines of the National Action Party and the Grey Wolves. He has effected something of a synthesis between the two. Pan-Turkism at a microscopic is the wrong word, at one level is something that can be seen as a vehicle for breaking up China and Russia. Also in the Muslim Brotherhood ideology at an economic level, the Muslim Brotherhood is an Islamic fascist organization whose primary economic theoretician is the 14th century philosopher Ibn Khaldun. That's I-B-N, K-H-A-L-D-U-N, that the World Bank hails as, quote, the first advocate of privatization. Looming in the background of pan-Turkism and the overlapping Muslim Brotherhood jihadism are A, the use of jihadists as proxy warriors to effect goals that the transnational corporations and international fascism wish to realize. The Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda fascists have been used against the former Soviet Union in Afghanistan. They have been used in the Balkans against the former regime of Yugoslavia. They have been used and are being used apparently in the Caucasus. And also, as we have seen in For the Record 348 and numerous programs in the For the Record series under the Going Native title, Going Native Part, you know, blah, 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 blah. The use of jihadis also is aimed at, well, in addition to breaking up larger countries and the use of jihadis as proxy warriors, at an economic theoretical level, with the Muslim Brotherhood's idealization of Ibn Khaldun and with the World Bank's idealization of Ibn Khaldun as well as, quote, the first advocate of privatization, we can see how the Orientalism that befuddles most observers notwithstanding, that lurking behind the Muslim Brotherhood and jihadism is an economic theory that is at one with the neoliberal economics that had become quite familiar to many people. Another thing that looms very large in the program we're going to do, and that concerns not only irony, but Orwellian newspeak. It is just remarkable to me at the extent to which elements in this country are accusing others of things that we do ourselves. And also it's worth noting that the policies that are being pursued by the anti-China faction, and Steve Bannon, Trump's former campaign chief or campaign manager, and at one point, certainly a top campaign official and his former chief of staff, is one of the primary organizers of the anti-Chinese effort. He has revived the Committee on the Present Danger, a Cold War era body that is now helping to drive the destabilization of China. What is interesting is that the policies being pursued against China are not only hurting Western commercial interests, numerous corporations that have relied on China, including some, frankly, sweatshop conditions, are being hurt by the anti-Chinese effort, but in an overall business sense, it is bad business. China is certainly not a democracy. Neither, frankly, are we. American democracy went by the boards on November 22nd of 1963. American democracy was blown all over the back of a limousine in Dallas, Texas on that day. And with that moment, the covert operations that had long been in effect abroad came home and have been used here as well. The difference is that in China, they say, look, you can't do this and you can't say that. You can do this and you can't say that. Here in the U.S., basically, you can do or say anything you want once. Okay? And if it is not to the liking of the powers that be, you are either marginalized or, frankly, outright censored, or if need be, killed. There are different ways of doing things here, and the covert action came home decades ago. One of the things, however, China's lack of democracy notwithstanding, they have made enormous progress in recent decades. In 1981, according to the World Bank, 88% of the Chinese population, the largest population in the world, were at or below the poverty line. By 2015, that was down to 0.7%. That is an enormous degree of progress. And again, the World Bank, hardly a bastion of international communist ideology. And by the same token, and perhaps even more importantly from a business standpoint, the Chinese middle class was at 4% of the population in 2002, up to 31%, almost an eight-fold increase in 18 years, according again to the World Bank and also to that other major bastion of international communist ideology and propagation, the Analysis Division of the CIA. That also is very, very important and a tremendous degree of progress. China's lack of democracy notwithstanding. Bottom line, China is the largest market in the world, something like 1.5 billion people, I think, at this point. And capitalism is a system of social organization that is predicated upon the conduct of commerce. Basically, you want people to buy stuff, and if people don't have money in their pockets, they can't buy stuff. If 88% of your population is impoverished, as it was in China in 1981, they can't buy stuff. When you knock that down to 0.7% by 2015, that is progress. And beyond that, and again, maybe even more importantly, when your middle class is at 4% in 2002, there aren't a lot of people who can buy stuff. But on the other hand, when you ramp that up almost eightfold to 31%, you have more people who can buy stuff. Again, people can't engage in commerce if they don't have money in their pockets. And when you have the largest market in the world, you want people to have money in their pockets so they can buy stuff. You know, and this isn't effing rocket science, okay? This is pretty basic. So the anti-China effort is not only hurting corporations in the U.S. and in other countries. We're going to be taking a look at German policies vis-a-vis China and how they are marching in lockstep with the U.S., and it is hurting German business as well. A leading spokesman for the top automobile manufacturing organization, their trade organization in Germany, recently complained about the policies the U.S. and Germany were pursuing vis-a-vis China, saying it was hurting the German automobile trade because basically fewer Chinese were buying German cars. That is the thing in essence. What we're going to be looking at, and as we get into the discussion, is how the passage of a piece of U.S. legislation which would punish China for the situation in Hong Kong and invite reciprocal action by China will ultimately be bad not only for American business, but for German business, and in all probability will be bad for Hong Kong as well. The point being that this is an ideology which is, I think, at a fundamental level, deeply racist. China is a world power and is growing. I personally, as I said a few weeks ago, I am now in my 41st year on the air, beginning my third generation on the air, and doing what I do takes a toll. And part of the price I have paid is idealism. I am a misanthrope at this point. Echoing Hamlet, I care not for man or women either. Individuals, yes, but people basically make me ill. Emery's first principle, most people are a-holes, and that's why the world is so full of S blank, blank, blank. And lurking beneath that is my interest in theoretical physics and, in an enlightened sense, my interest in Buddhism as well. They overlap, and sometime perhaps I'll attempt to connect some of the bots, but generally, for the purposes of the present discussion, I have a low opinion of human nature, whether you're Chinese or American or German or whoever. I don't think much of the human race. I'm very disappointed in them. So it would not surprise me. In fact, I think we can assume there are all sorts of manifestations of injustice in China. Indeed, the Chinese themselves are fairly candid about that. Unlike here, we have no such thing here. You know, it's funny, as I'm speaking, October 22nd of the year 2019, today's edition of the New York Times, at least the Western edition, is filled with stories about riots and lethal goings-on in numerous countries that are part of the Western field, a sphere of influence, I should say, most of those in the third world, and yet that gets buried and we're not hearing about that. What we're hearing about is, you know, the yellow devils in China. China is a world power and at this point the second largest GDP on earth behind the U.S. It may be down to three at this point, I don't know. But what is interesting is that China is, of course, an Asian nation, and I think working beneath what is, from a business standpoint, a suicidal policy. You don't want to be messing up the largest market in the world. You want people in that market to have money in their pocket. You want them lifted out of poverty. You want them to enter the middle class. It is state capitalism, as the Chinese call it. They are not alone. Here in the U.S., T-Mobile is one of the largest mobile phone providers. They also own Metro PCS. They may soon be merging with Sprint to form one of the largest American carriers. T-Mobile is a subsidiary of Deutsche Telekom. That is majority, a controlling interest in that company is owned by the German government. So what that means basically is that the U.S. opposition to state capitalism, unquote, as China calls it, is selective. We don't have any objection to T-Mobile, but we do have objections to China. And again, it makes no sense from the business standpoint to be messing with China and hurting not only U.S. and German and other corporations, but also those retail outlets in the U.S. that are dependent on reasonably priced goods that are assembled and or manufactured in China, and also those American consumers who don't have a lot of money and basically are dependent on buying things made in China because that is all they can damn well afford at this point. So what we're seeing, I think, is one of the most deeply reactionary political phenomena on earth, and one that is at a fundamental level deeply racist and harkens back to the colonial period, where basically the bloody wogs, as the British call them, wog is a deeply racist term. It doesn't sound so much so racist to American ears. WOG stands for Wily Oriental Gentleman, but it is, in British context, it is deeply racist. And I think looking at China, they're bloody wogs in the view of the West, and they will not be permitted to be a world power. And I think what is going on is not only very destructive from a global economic standpoint, hurting U.S. corporations, U.S. consumers, as well as China, but I think it threatens a third world war. I'm convinced that China is scheduled for the same sort of breakup as the former Soviet Union, and in For the Record program number 1091, we briefly revisited the full court press strategy as outlined by Pershing Gervais in Covert Action number 35. We went into that in AFA 36 at greater length, and I think that China is scheduled for the same sort of full-court press. It is experiencing the same sort of full-court press activity that the former Soviet Union achieved or was subjected to with the same goal. I am afraid that it may, unlike what happened with the Soviet Union, this may result in a Third World War, and that will be the end of all of us. In any event, that is a long introduction. The irony in the following story is just, if there were a Guinness Book of World Records record for irony, this story might just capture it. From the New York Times of September 6th of 2019, an article by Stephen Lee Myers, M-Y-E-R-S, with protests, China angrily connects the dots back to the U.S. Listen to this opening couple of sentences, skipping down. China has a long history of blaming, quote, foreign forces, unquote, for challenges it has faced internally, including the Tiananmen Square protests 30 years ago. Imagine that, the Chinese blaming foreign forces. As we will see, they're talking about the National Endowment for Democracy, and there is a well-documented involvement of the NED, which is a U.S. intelligence cutout, with the forces active in Hong Kong. We went into that at great length in For the Record 1091 and came back to it in 1092. But notice this. This is from the New York Times, which perhaps as much, if not more, than any other media voice, perhaps second only to Rachel Maddow, has been flogging the Russiagate nonsense, and nonsense it is. We've gone into that in the past. Aside from the ludicrous information vis-a-vis the hacks and the high-profile hacks, that is technical. Blaming, for example, Russian-originated Facebook posts for Donald Trump's victory in 2016 is remarkable. There were roughly 50,000 Facebook posts of Russian origin, by no means all of them which could be linked to the Russian government. That is out of 33 trillion Facebook posts in the same time. That is roughly 16 millionths of 1% of the Facebook posts, and we are supposed to believe that helped to swing the U.S. election. The whole thing is that bad. For the U.S., to blame the rise of Donald Trump on Russia is rather like the Roman Empire blaming the ascent of Caligula on Carthage. It is just ludicrous. And again, it is incredibly ironic here. China has a long history of blaming foreign forces, unquote, for challenges it has faced internally. This from the New York Times, which has been flogging the Russiagate nonsense. Continuing. Analysts said they reflect the thinking of an increasingly anxious leadership that sees any manifestation of popular sentiment in the streets as a potential color revolution like those that swept Georgia, Ukraine, and later the Arab world. A 42-page report released recently by China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs singled out the National Endowment for Democracy, the congressionally funded organization founded in 1983 to support the spread of democracy and human rights around the world, accusing it of underwriting a similar revolution in Hong Kong. Quote, the U.S. is not satisfied in overt oral support for Hong Kong, but resorts to financial backing, unquote, the state English language television network CGTN wrote with inexact grammar in an article posted on its website and included in the ministry's report. The article went on to argue that the endowment acted in concert with the Central Intelligence Agency, quote, in covert actions against governments, unquote. The involvement of the NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, with the interests that are stirring things up in Hong Kong is a matter of public record. We went into that public record in 1091 and came back in 1092. What was worth noting is the tone here. The Chinese that claim the MEB, you know, works for the CIA and covert actions. And we've spoken, by the way, about what's going on in Ukraine and the Arab Spring in many programs. And those are indeed overt covert operations, as we looked at. And for the record, 733 to 739 in the case of the Arab Spring. And in many programs, vis-a-vis Ukraine, after we finish talking about China, we are going to come back to our Fascism 2019 World Tour and take a look at what is going on in Ukraine, because that is really interesting. Again, noting here what they're saying, that the New York Times is poo-pooing, wow, you know, the Chinese are so crazy. They claim the MEB works for the CIA and covert actions against governments. From the Pando Daily of July 31st of 2015 by Mark Ames, what Pierre did next, this is about Pierre Omidyar of eBay, who has worked with both the MEB, the National Endowment for Democracy, and the U.S. Agency for International Development, both of which have worked as cutouts for U.S. intelligence. And Ames writes, skipping down, I can't think of another media tycoon who co-funded a pro-U.S. regime change with American intelligence cutouts like USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy. That Putin targeted the MEB does not mean it's either heroic or evil. The MEB's story speaks for itself. The brainchild of Reagan's CIA director, Bill Casey, the National Endowment for Democracy was set up as an intelligence cutout to support U.S. geopolitical power and undermine unfriendly regimes. One of the MEB co-founders, Alan Weinstein, W-E-I-N-S-T-E-I-N, explained its purpose to the Washington Post. Again, this is one of the founders of the MEB. Quote, a lot of what we do today was done covertly 25 years ago by the CIA. In other words, basically exactly what the Chinese were saying. Among the recipients of MEB financing is an activist named Joshua Wong, whose Demosisto, D-E-M-O-S-I-S-T-O party in Hong Kong has gotten funding from MEB.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
What we're going to look at next is not only the German role, marching in lockstep with the U.S., but in particular, how legislation that is pending in the U.S., the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, will not only hurt American business in Hong Kong, but German business and, in all probability, the Hong Kong economy itself. From German foreign policy, which feeds along the front page of the, there's a link, the feeding has to be updated, but there is a link on the front page of the SpitfireList.com website. From German foreign policy of September 10th of 2019, protests in Hong Kong. Monday evening, activist Joshua Wong, parenthetically funded by the MEB, arrived in Berlin from Hong Kong for talks with German politicians, including Foreign Minister Heiko Maas, M-A-A-S. Wong represents an opposition party that calls for a referendum, including a vote on Hong Kong's future secession from China. Just before his trip to Berlin, demonstrators rallied on Sunday in front of the U.S. consulate in Hong Kong, calling on U.S. President Trump to intervene in their favor with city authorities. Already since March, high-ranking members of Hong Kong's opposition have repeatedly visited Washington for talks with U.S. Vice President Mike Pence and U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Berlin is now following suit and receiving leaders of the Hong Kong protests for talks with top government officials. Washington is preparing new legislation for sanctions providing for punitive measures against Chinese officials and putting Hong Kong's special economic status into question. Billions in German business transactions are also at risk. Again, what is pending is bad for American business, bad for German business, and bad for Hong Kong, which is why I think what is going on here is a profoundly racist and, frankly, atavistic phenomenon in which, frankly, the wogs, the dirty little yellow-skinned, slant-eyed Chinese devils will not be permitted to be a world power, because what is going on is bad for business all across the board. It is just bad business. Also, thinking before we continue into this article, imagine if a Chinese soft power body like NED were helping to finance American political activists, say, New Green Deal activists or Black Lives Matter protesters or Occupy Wall Street protesters. Then a Chinese diplomat meets with those protesters, and then they begin flying Chinese flags. Can you imagine that? And throwing rocks and throwing gasoline bombs at cops, sabotaging subway trains. It was an improvised explosive device that went off a couple of weeks ago. They would not be called free speech advocates or pro-democracy advocates at all. They would be called terrorists and rioters. So again, the newspeak aspects of this are really, really remarkable. Now, returning to protests in Hong Kong, the next U.S. sanctions legislation, under the title Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, unquote, Washington is preparing new sanctions legislation. Its draft was initially introduced on November 16th of 2016 during the administration of U.S. President Barack Obama. This past June 13th, U.S. Senator Marco Rubio, a Republican hardliner from Florida, along with Jim McGovern, Democratic congressman from Massachusetts, reintroduced the Bipartisan Act in Congress. The act would require the State Department to issue an annual report on the situation in Hong Kong and, quote, certification of Hong Kong's autonomy to justify special treatment afforded to Hong Kong by the U.S. It would also require the U.S. president, quote, to identify persons complicit in suppressing basic freedoms, unquote. Their punishment would be a denial of entry into the U.S. and, quote, a freezing of their U.S.-based assets, unquote. The Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act is thus in line with the rapidly growing number of other U.S. sanction laws that Washington imposes at will to bully those abroad whose policies it considers objectionable. The next section is crucial here. It's titled A Double-Edged Sword, and again, in terms of analyzing what is going on in Hong Kong and the full court press against China, it is bad for business. You want the largest market in the world to have a lot of people with money in their pocket so they can buy things. I mean, just basic stuff. You don't want to mess it up. It is also hurting consumers in this country and corporations in this country, hurting American farmers. It is bad for business. That, again, maybe I'm flogging the horse a little too much, but what we're seeing is really, really, really bad commercial policy. Really bad. And that is why I think what is going on here is so important and so deeply racist. It is almost pre-fascist. This harkens back to 17th, 18th century Western imperial policy. And the bottom line is that China is a major world power. They are the second largest economy in the world, and that will not be permitted if they are basically a bunch of, you know, dirty, yellow-skinned, slant-eyed you-know-whats, basically bloody wogs, as a British racist and imperialist might have called them. And again, this is strong language, but I think that is the bottom line. Because of their race, they will not be permitted to be a world power. The Japanese are also of Asian extraction, but because they looted, not Asian extraction, they are Asian, but because they looted the entire liquid wealth of Asia during the war, the Second World War, they are a gold broker and part of a giant global covert action machine. We will come back to that in our next program or two. But again, noting how bad the policies being pursued here are for business. It's bad for American business. It is bad for German business. It is bad for Hong Kong business. And yet, this is what they are doing. From a double-edged sword. Washington's threat to deprive Hong Kong of its special economic status is a double-edged sword. The former British colony is an important economic gateway between Western countries and China, through which trade and investments are still being transacted with the People's Republic of China on a large scale. Hong Kong is the U.S.'s 10th largest goods export market. Last year, it purchased around $37.5 billion in U.S. goods. At the same time, the U.S. goods trade surplus of Hong Kong was $31.2 billion. According to government data, U.S. foreign direct investment in Hong Kong was $81.2 billion in 2017. All of this would be at risk if the U.S. administration deprives Hong Kong of its special status. Not only the Chinese, but the U.S. economy would suffer serious damage. Most likely, Hong Kong would also be affected by this measure. Companies in the metropolis are already complaining of business losses due to the protests. Economists estimate that the city could face a recession. Revoking the special status would massively worsen the situation. Hong Kong would run the risk of losing its economic importance. Already last year, neighboring metropolis Shenzhen's gross domestic product surpassed that of Hong Kong. Soon, Guangzhou, the second neighboring metropolis, could catch up with Hong Kong's gross domestic product. It is all the more astonishing that the pro-Western opposition in Hong Kong is so adamantly campaigning for the passage of this Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act. Since March at the latest, talks have been documented between leading officials of the Trump administration and representatives of the opposition. For example, on March 22nd, Anson Chan, who served as chief Secretary of the British Colonial Administration from 1993 to 1997, and later from 1997 to 2001 in the same office for the decolonized Hong Kong government, held talks with Vice President Mike Pence to discuss, quote, human rights in the city. May 16th, Martin Lee, also, by the way, associated with monies coming from the NED, founder of Hong Kong's Democratic Party, held talks on the same subject with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. July 8th, Hong Kong's media tycoon Jimmy Lai met with Vice President Mike Pence and shortly thereafter with John Bolton, President Donald Trump's National Security Advisor, by the way, since replaced. In mid-August, parliamentarians of the Liberal Civic Party were in Washington for talks last Sunday. In front of the U.S. consulate in Hong Kong, a few thousand demonstrators demanded the passage of the law. We, quote, trust, unquote, the Trump government one of the demonstrators explained, as the rally was held under U.S. flags. By the way, they may trust Trump. Speaking strictly for myself, I don't. Continuing. Thereafter, protesters vandalized subway stations, attacked subway attendants, erected barricades, and attacked police stations. One subway entrance was set on fire. This is the classical escalation strategy also used during the Maidan protests in Ukraine. To provoke a reaction from the police and furnish the Western media images for their anti-Chinese reporting. And about the effect on Germany, German business of these same events. The passage of the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act would also have grave consequences for Germany. With its trade volume of nearly 8 billion euros, Germany is Hong Kong's largest trade partner in the EU. Last two sentences again. The passage of the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act would have grave consequences for Germany as well. With its trade volume of nearly 8 billion euros, Germany is Hong Kong's largest trade partner in the EU. According to the Bundesbank, German companies have invested around 5 billion euros in the city. This metropolis, in which around 600 German companies have a presence, is still considered, as confirmed by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, quote, to be an important gateway to the Chinese market, unquote. Therefore, Germany's Foreign Chamber of Commerce, or AHK, in Hong Kong, is strongly advocating a peaceful settlement of the conflict, particularly the, quote, episodes of unprecedented violence and vandalism, unquote, during the protests were, quote, indefensible and harmed our city's reputation, unquote, the institution declared. Again, this is not the Chinese government. This is Germany's Foreign Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong. Again, advocating a peaceful settlement. And said particularly the, quote, episodes of unprecedented violence and vandalism, unquote, during the protests were, quote, indefensible, unquote, and, again, quoting, harmed our city's reputation, unquote, the institution declared. During her visit to Beijing at the end of last week, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, whose top priority was to promote German business interests, spoke in favor of solving the conflict through dialogue, unquote. Everything must be done to avoid violence, unquote, the chancellor declared. Simultaneously, transatlantic-oriented circles in particular are pushing for an escalation of the conflict. For example, the chair of the Greens, Annalena Baerbock, asserted that Beijing's pressure on Hong Kong must have, quote, consequences, unquote, for German-Chinese business cooperation. The foreign policy spokesperson for the FDP Bundestag group, Bijan Jir-Sarai, has even suggested that Chancellor Angela Merkel renounce her trip. Yesterday, Joshua Wong, again funded by MEB, one of the leaders of the Hong Kong opposition, arrived in Berlin, where he claims to be exploring whether Germany could be a suitable asylum country for Hong Kong protesters. He also seeks to convince Germany to ban all Chinese from entering the country who are responsible for human rights violations in Hong Kong and to freeze their accounts. Should Germany do this, it would be anticipating the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act. A massive conflict with Beijing could be expected over such open interference in the domestic affairs of the People's Republic of China. Foreign Minister Heiko Maas has already announced yesterday that he was prepared to receive Joshua Wong for talks. And again, that speaks for itself. Suffice it to say that what is going on in Hong Kong and the pending legislation in the U.S. is bad for business. Bad for Hong Kong business. It's bad for American business. It is bad for Chinese business. And it is bad for German business as well. What the overall destabilization of China effort really is, again, I think it is a throwback to an extremely dark social and political manifestation, and is deeply, I think, white supremacist in its manifestation. China, as an Asian country, is not going to be permitted to be a real global power. What we're going to look at next is the use of the Uyghurs as a proxy warrior component inside of China. We've spoken about this in many programs, For the Record 348, For the Record 549, and again in 550. The Uyghurs, again, are a Muslim Turkophone minority in Xinjiang Autonomous Province. That's capital X-I-N-J-I-A-N-G. I am probably mispronouncing that. They have strong links with Al-Qaeda, with the Muslim Brotherhood, with ISIS, and they are being sponsored not only by Erdogan, Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey, and his pan-Turkism, but also with NATO. We may not have time to go into this. We went into the Uyghur links with Al-Qaeda in many shows. In For the Record 348, to illustrate some of the Orwellian irony in this, we spoke about, among other things, Uyghur jihadis associated with Al-Qaeda engaging in firefights with U.S. troops in Afghanistan. It remains to be seen. There is a significant Uyghur jihadi presence in Syria as well. I have no idea whether they engaged in firefights with American special forces or Marines in Syria. That remains to be seen. It would not surprise me. I have not seen any articles about that. Suffice it to say, of 28 militias that are now working for Mr. Erdogan from Turkey in their invasion of Syria and their ethnic cleansing of the Kurds, some 21 of them had at one time or another been financed by the CIA and or U.S. intelligence.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Of the Uyghurs and the carving up of China, again from German Foreign Policy, this from November 15th, of 2018, setting the sights on East Turkestan, Part 1. The German government is participating in the West's campaign against China's anti-terrorist measures in its Xinjiang Autonomous Region. The Chinese authorities are taking massive repressive measures against Uyghur terrorists and their milieu. They are being held in camps, which Beijing says are, quote, educational centers, unquote. Western governments are calling them re-education camps, unquote. Information on how many are being held range from a few tens of thousands to a million. During his inaugural visit to that country, Germany's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Heiko Maas, publicly criticized China on this question. Beijing objected to Berlin's interference in its domestic affairs. Over the past few years, hundreds and possibly thousands have fallen victim to Uyghur separatist terrorism against Han Chinese. Uyghur jihadis are also fighting within the ranks of the Islamic State. The Uyghur secessionists, who seek to separate Xinjiang, calling it East Turkestan, from China, are receiving support from Western countries, including Germany. By the way, this should be seen like others. I have no idea. Well, I cannot tell past the point what exactly is going on in those camps. I don't imagine it is much worse than what is going on at Guantanamo or what went on at some of the camps in Iraq, but that remains to be seen. What is a matter of public record is that not only Islamic jihadism of the Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, ISIS brand, but also the overlapping, though not coterminous, pan-Turkism of Mr. Erdogan, by the way, being supported by the unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, founded by Karl von Habsburg, which also, by the way, supports the Lakota and their potential secession in the area of the Midwestern U.S. that it comprises the Bakken oil fields as well. So the sword being wielded here, it will ultimately, as things take their course, be wielded against the U.S., the same UNPO that we looked at in, for the record, 550, that supports the Uyghurs in China, also supports the Lakota, and favors their secession from the U.S. This is not to cast aspersions on the Lakota, but rather the UNPO as a classically cynical organization that seeks to exploit minority interests within larger sovereign nations in order to effect secession, which then will give the control of key mineral resources over to the transnational corporations. Again, going back to setting the sights on East Turkestan. Berlin is using the measures being taken by the Chinese authorities in Western China's Xinjiang Autonomous Region to help intensify international pressure on the People's Republic of China. At the meeting of the UN Human Rights Council on Tuesday of last week, Germany, in league with France, Great Britain, Canada, and the U.S., called on Beijing to shut down the camps for Uyghurs in Xinjiang immediately. On Thursday, the German Bundestag debated a motion tabled by the Green Party group calling on the German government to demand of China that, quote, all camps and detention facilities be closed and the imprisoned be immediately and unconditionally set free, unquote. The Bundestag also debated sanctions against Chinese officials. Monday, Germany's Foreign Minister Heiko Maas upped the ante during his inaugural visit in Beijing, where he declared, quote, we cannot accept re-education camps, unquote. The People's Republic of China must, quote, develop transparency, unquote, so that the outside world can, quote, make a final verdict on what is happening. By the way, Donald Trump has been quite vocal condemning China's policy towards the Uyghurs and Muslims in general. That is more than a little ironic. There are those who would claim that Donald Trump himself has maintained something of an anti-Muslim stance. Continuing in a section called Blatant Interference, Beijing strongly objects to Germany's and other Western countries' interference. In a letter dated last Friday, the Chinese embassy in Berlin characterized the Bundestag's Xinjiang debate, quote, a blatant interference in China's domestic affairs and a gross violation of its sovereignty. The People's Republic of China seeks dialogue with Germany, quote, on the basis of equality and mutual respect, unquote. The German government should take this note of protest seriously, quote, to ensure that German-Chinese relations develop in the proper direction, unquote. China's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Wang Yi, W-A-N-G, capital Y-I, categorically rejected Maas's subsequent intervention in Beijing, quote, this is China's domestic issue, unquote. Wang declared, following his meeting with Mars. In Xinjiang, the issue is, quote, the prevention of terrorism, unquote. The camps are a, quote, preventive measure, unquote. And again, in numerous shows from, for the record, 348, 549, 550, and many of the shows in the Going Native series, we have spoken about Uyghur terrorism. And next, terror in Xinjiang. Again, that is a semi-autonomous region of China that is not only very rich in mineral resources, but petroleum in particular, rather like the Lakota Territory in the U.S., which is on top of the Bakken oil, basically oil shale field. We went into that in For the Record 550. Continuing. In fact, China's measures in Xinjiang are part of its anti-terrorism operation. It is a Chinese alternative to the West's war on terror, which, since 2001, has included the abduction of suspects to foreign torture chambers in Europe as well as the U.S., and the use of drone attacks on suspects, which have caused numerous civilian casualties. Already since the 1990s, Xinjiang has been faced with terrorist attacks by members of the Turkic-speaking Uyghur minority, fighting to secede this autonomous region from China to found East Turkestan, unquote. Some seek an eventual fusion with the Turkic-speaking countries of Central Asia. The attacks that became known in the West include a Uyghur terrorist attack at a coal mine in Xinjiang in September of 2015. The assailants deliberately targeted non-Turkic-speaking workers, especially those of China's majority Han population, slaughtering them with long knives. According to Western media reports, at least 50 died in the attack. On March 1st of 2014, 8 Uyghur terrorists armed also with knives attacked civilian travelers in a train station of Kunming, the capital of Yunnan province, killing 31 and wounding around 150, some seriously. There have also been recurring pogroms targeting Han Chinese. For example, in July 2009, several thousand Uyghurs in Xinjiang's capital, Urumqi, capital U-R-U-M-Q-I, attacked Han Chinese. According to official figures, 197 people were killed. However, observers calculate the actual body count to be much higher. Just imagine if something like that were going on in the U.S. How would that be portrayed? How would the American people react to that? We are going to continue this in this line of discussion in our next program. And again, note the pan-Turkist dynamic, which is one of the things that is manifesting in Syria right now. By the way, Syria, the bloodbath there, is ultimately an outgrowth of the Arab Spring, one of the color revolutions, something I spoke about in For the Record 733 to 739. I remember when that was going on that I was catching a ration of fresh fertilizer from many people. And the line of discussion in the so-called progressive sector, as well as in the mainstream media, was, oh, in Egypt and the other Muslim countries, they're going to establish a moderate Islamic democracy along the lines of what Erdogan has in Turkey. Yeah, that's some moderate Islamic democracy he has there, isn't it? Yes, sir. How moderate can you get? Well, just ask the Kurds how they like that, quote, moderation, unquote. Anyway, we will continue with this in our next program. This concludes For the Record program number 1093, The Destabilization of China, Part 4. This is being recorded on October 22nd of the year 2019. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.